Hello and welcome to From the Rookery End. This is the podcast we thought would never happen, where we get to talk about talking to Gino Pozzo. Yes, after 11 years of being at the club and a lot of asking and a lot of organising and a lot of negotiating, last night Watford fans got to be in a room with Mr. Gino Pozzo and Scott Duxbury, but Gino for the first time, to ask questions and find out a little bit more about the man and what's going on at Watford Football Club. Now, luckily, because we're part of the gang who put it together, organised it, Mike and I were there. And Mike is with me now. Good evening, Mike.
Hello, John. How are you feeling?
Chipper, I think. It is the end of the week, but also it's the day after us, the release that we had after putting together this event. And it went and the event went well.
I think release is right, isn't it? Because it was a difficult, challenging, but I think overall enjoyable experience, wasn't it? Coming together with the guys from Do Not Scratch Your Eyes. And we have to say, Pete did an absolutely magnificent job of hosting the event. I thought it was really, really good. Probably what won't have been picked up on the blog and subsequent pieces that Andrew's done is just the little asides that Pete threw in just to break the ice a little bit. There's a bit of humour. He wasn't afraid to crack a joke at the expense of himself, the football club, or indeed Gino Pozzo and Scott Duxbury. So a massive, massive kudos to Pete for his role. I thought he played an absolutely blinding hand. You did well, of course, John. You were the roving mic. But there was a real cast of characters from Do Not Scratch Your Eyes, from the Watford Buzz, Mike and Ben from Voices of the Vic, Tom from the Watford fans here from Golden Pages. A real team effort to get it over the line. And as most people will have realised, there were a couple of curveballs in the days leading up to the event that we probably could have done without. Everyone could have done without, really. But it was what it did show is that when their fans are minded to get together and do something, to put their mind to it, quite a lot is possible as a group of football supporters. We did it not because we're podcasters, not because we wanted the content, not because we wanted just to be in the room. We did it because we were football supporters that care about our football club. The challenge was set down and we took on that challenge. And I like to think we tackled it head on.
We didn't want to miss the opportunity, I think, for me. It was the first time it could have slipped away. If it had been left for, just open and someone will do it. But actually, we sort of gathered it almost instantly when it first started.
Yeah, and maybe someone else would. And that's not to say, we're not white knights in shining armour, galloping in on our white horses to save the day. That's not what we're saying at all. But I did like the way we got together and worked together and made it happen. But there is a big question, really. When you're sitting in the room last night and you think about all the to-ing and fro-ing that we had to go through to get there, all the hard work we did with getting the questions and working on the format and the tough decisions we had to make. The football club really could have said, right, on the 15th of June, there will be an opportunity to speak to Gino Pozzo and Scott Duxbury at Watford Training Ground. Refreshments will be provided. There's room for 80 people. If you want to attend, put your name and fan ID into email. Your club or whatever it is at watfordfc.com, we'll draw 80 people at random and they'll be able to ask questions. It's pretty disappointing, I think, that the club didn't feel able to do that.
They didn't, I think, because I think they and we and everybody got burned after what happened last year. And they probably wanted it to seem like, look, you set the terms for what you guys want, because clearly what we tried to last year didn't work. I think that's probably where their brain started with... Their thought process, not their brain. Their thought process started with why they asked fans to sort of to take the lead on it a little bit. You can read the things that were said and in great detail on the Watford Observer, because Andrew was allowed to do the live blog and to record it. We wanted to put it out for audio, but that was decided not the best way to do it. But I suppose what we want to do with this podcast is to, two of us are in the room. We got to meet Gino. And we want to sort of share what we felt about it as us as fans. And if you were there as well, because there were 80 people in that room, as well as Scott and Gino, what did you find out about it? What did you like about it? Do give us a shout. We spoke to lots and lots of people afterwards, and it was good to sort of see that they all take something different from it. Something else stood out to everybody. Your impression of him was slightly different, but we're going to talk about our feelings behind it. Let's say where we did it. He came in, Michael. with a beard. And he looked a little bit different. So, oh, not what I was expecting. A little beard since last time we saw him. But in terms of it, you know, we know Scott really well. We've met him a couple of times and done interviews with him, seen him at many events. He's great with a crowd. He's comfortable there. But we hadn't seen Gino. And I had to ask the first few questions, sort of, not my questions. They were the sort of the questions that were led in from the 1,400 questions that we had sent in via the online polls and forms that we had. And I wasn't quite sure how to sort of take him, what to do, how light can the mood be, or how serious is the mood going to be. But before that happened, he did stand up and he did say a speech and he sort of gave a welcome, didn't he? And in that, he for me, he came across as a, not overly, but definitely a serious man.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because of all the toing and froing with the organisation and how much sort of headspace it took up. As I was sat stuck in traffic on the M25, anyone that's trying to get to London Colney at sort of 5, 6, 7 o'clock on a weekday evening will know exactly what I mean. I was thinking, oh my goodness, we're about to hear from Gino Pozzo in a minute. We're so caught up in the actual organising of it that you forget sometimes what the actual event is going to be like. And I was a bit trepidatious. I was got a bit sort of, oh, crikey, I wonder what he's going to be like you. Is he going to be stern, effusive? Is he going to be jolly? Is he going to be annoyed he's there? Is he going to be... I had no idea what he was going to be like. And you're right, John, he picked up the mic and he kind of seized the metal, didn't he? And kind of set the tone. I thought he was going to be quite brief with his opening remarks. But in fact, he was very, very, very complete in talking, wasn't he? It was a summary of what's happened so far, why he feels like he hasn't felt the opportunity, felt the need to speak to supporters or indeed journalists since that interview with Frank Smith way back. And what struck me straight away is whether you like Gino or not, or whether you agree with what he's doing at the football club or not, as an orator, as someone who can hold the attention of a room, he's excellent. And I felt a little bit naive, I felt a little bit silly, because I wondered whether a part of me was wondering whether a part of Gino has not wanted to do it, because he doesn't enjoy it, he's not very good at it. And whilst he still may not enjoy it, he's definitely good at it. He is very, very comfortable with a mic. His command of the language is absolutely superb. Whether or not that was ever in doubt, I don't know. I went to Question Time once with my mum, and when I was quite young, and I remember seeing, I think it was Michael Heseltine take the mic, one of the big beasts of the Tory party back then, when politicians were actually proper human beings. And I remember thinking, crikey, that is impressive how he sort of took the question, answered what he wanted to answer, but did it in a way that, you know, you could hear a pin drop. Everyone was focused on him. Everyone was dialed into what he was saying. His choice of language was on the money. And Gino, I thought, was very, very similar to that. And I think we'll come back to why saying he's like a politician is quite apt later. But in terms of sort of his tone and how he was able to control the room and quite cleverly, I think, control the sort of speed of the night, if you like, because there could have been people who have gone into the room really ready and primed to have a bit of a go at Gino, because we know there's lots of disquiet for a whole host of reasons. But what he did was he expertly took the sting and the pace out of the evening by semi-answering a lot of questions, sort of semi... He didn't never apologise, he didn't apologise for anything, but he explained why he's never spoken before. So that's probably a couple of questions sort of chalked off the list straight away. So I thought that opening monologue was very, very impressive. It took me by surprise quite how good he was in the room. And I also thought it was very, very savvy, just in terms of setting the tone, letting everyone know, you've organised this, I'm probably here under duress slightly, but I'm still end up going to bossing it. I'm still going to end up being in charge of what I say, how long I say it for. And that sort of thing. So very, 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 very canny, I thought, from Gino, that opening monologue.
There was one moment, because I was slightly surprised, when he was invited by Richard Walker, who was sort of the main person for the club there, and he sort of said, if you'd like to speak, and he stood up, and he had the microphone, and he stood, and he looked around, and he did his speech, and he sat down. Then a question was asked, so I asked him a question, and then he stood up again. And he answered his question and he sat back down again. And he stood up for every single question that he answered. And I wasn't sure if that was
apart
him.
Apart from mine.
Well, this is the bit. I think there was a point where did he think that's what he had to do? Because Scott's done loads of them. And Scott didn't actually answer anything for a little while. And so he was standing up and saying his bit and sitting down and standing up. Did he not go, oh, you mean we can sit down? Until Scott did his first answer, just picked the microphone up, gave his answer, then put the microphone down. He went, you mean I can sit down? Ah, yeah, there was a little bit of, was he even doing it to sort of say, I'm standing up and I'm strong? You know, who knows? But that's the way it is. You know, let's go through a couple of the sort of topics, because, you know, how he came across will come out through that. You know, we asked him about managers and the whole manager situation and Rob Edwards and how he viewed that and the changes he made and how quickly. And basically, you know, he has no regrets.
Absolutely.
He feels
not.
That every decision he made at the time was right. And there was no sort of talking through him saying, you know, anything about in terms of what he had done wrong at the time and were those decisions wrong. He wasn't really drawn ever if he was going to talk about long-term commitment. I found really interesting when it came to that, he talked about the next appointment, or the appointment of Valerian. He talked about the technical team, and they had had time to find someone and find the best choice that they wanted. He had changed his approach, but he seemed to know what he wants in terms of, that was his approach. When asked, have you changed your approach? He was like, well, this is what we want. And this is what we went out to find. So I don't think necessarily the approach has changed. Maybe the people doing it, with Ben Manga there this time. And he did point out that changing the managers mid-season, as he's done regularly, is very different. It's a very, very different, very, very limited process. And
well,
I think it's that first
the pool of bad managers that are available are limited, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. But the main thing is, he was, you know, the no regrets part, Mike, was the not good to hear, not bad to hear, but very telling to hear, I suppose, that he wasn't going to say that any of his decisions were ever wrong.
Yeah, and I started, my hackles were raised quite early, actually, in that piece. As you'll know, John, you made the mistake of standing close to me with the mic. I started tugging you on the jean, saying, let me speak, let me add him, and you quite rightly walked off and left me there and got some proper people to ask some questions. But you're absolutely right. One thing that man certainly has is the courage of his convictions. He makes no apologies for hiring and firing the managers. And you did put the question to him, how has the approach changed? What is going to be different to the other, I don't know, however many managers it is now. I'm not sure what we're up to. And there wasn't really a good answer to it, was there? There wasn't really a satisfactory answer. And I think the problem I had very early on with the answers about the managers was that he talked about Rob Edwards being a bad fit. Mm. And he could see that pretty early on, and therefore he acted. I believe that. I get that. So Rob Edwards, Forest Green, small, tight-knit, and I'm not being disparaging to our friends up the M1 for the purposes of this, I'm being deadly serious. They are small and tight-knit, and that's where why they've ended up where they are, of course. All power to them. But you can see the similarities there in that slightly smaller, potentially less resourced club, where there's less links in the chain, there's less need to potentially be managing up. You can see how Rob Edwards would be a better fit up the M1 than he is at Watford in its current guise. So that I get. But what, as the night went on, he used that phrase quite a lot. Oh, he just wasn't a good fit. He wasn't quite the right fit. He didn't quite fit in with what we're doing. And that was the excuse for virtually every manager.
Which made the role feel quite remote in terms of the workings of the club. You know, almost like it felt the way he talked about them, they're the outsider. They talked about, of course, they want to have long-term managers. But actually, you need to come and fit into us.
Yeah,
which is not quite the thing to do. It doesn't really feel like that's the 100%. Now, it might not be. We didn't hear from Ben Manga. We didn't hear from Cristiano Giaretta. And Gino did keep referring to it. And Scott did as well. They are the technical team.
Just one thing on that before I forget. A lot of people did speak to Cristiano Giaretta and Ben Manga and Scott Duxbury and Gino Pozzo one-on-one after the event.
Yeah, I mean, they did an hour and a half. They did 2 hours.
Yeah.
In the chairs in front of everybody, and I think they did at least an hour and a half afterwards, one-on-ones.
They were in no rush to go at all. They made themselves available to everyone, which is absolutely to their credit.
And I think even the other senior managers, Emilio, who's the main finance man, he went and found the people who had asked financial questions. I saw him do that. Yeah. So yeah, you're right. That was part of the overall event. But that remoteness, that technical team, that was an interesting thing to sort of learn about a little bit in terms of, you know, why, not the problem, the problems that we've seen. If that manager is so remote, it's, you know, they feel distant from them.
Yeah, it's not remote, is it? I know exactly what you mean. It's sort of almost ring-fenced, isn't it? They have to come in and deal with what they're given. So at the moment, it's Giaretta, it's Ben Manger and Helena Costa, there's Scott as chief exec, there's Gino Pozzo as the all-seeing boss. So the bottom line is any head coach has to come in and deal with that. And a lot of head coaches are coming in and having to deal with that and not really succeeding, are they? So they were very, very confident in this technical team, in this... Mm. And Gino was at pains to point out throughout to a number of different questions that my role is just to get the right people in and then to let them do it. Now, we all have our own question marks as to quite how standoffish Gino is, and there's enough evidence to say that he's probably more hands-on than he was willing to let on last night. But if he's so confident in this crack team that he's put together, and we can kind of let Ben Manger off the hook in that regard, because he hasn't really been at the club long enough to make an impact. But if he's so confident in the team he's put together in terms of Giaretta and those sort of people, why is every manager or head coach that's coming in only lasting a couple of months? That's my question. And what you have to admire about him is the courage of his convictions. Is he's like, no, these are the people I want at the club. This is what I want them to do. That's how I want this football club of mine to operate. The head coach will come in and he'll deal with it. And if he can't, he's out. And like you say, John, he has absolutely no regrets about any of the hiring or any of the firing. You assume that he makes the hire with the intention of that manager being the one that will hang around for a bit and get Watford back up to the heights, which we all hope they can get back to one day. But he is merciless. And he is merciless, I think, because he believes in what he's created there in terms of the framework for a head coach to work within. What I am still massively less than convinced is that that framework is correct, or at least the personnel within that framework are correct. We've seen far too much failure with that setup for us not to continue questioning it, I think. So whilst I admire their confidence in it and I admire their willingness to stand up and go, no, this is what we want it to be, this is what it's going to continue to be, I have severe doubts as to whether that's going to work. And one thing that we can, I know we'll do a wrap up at the end, but one thing is very, very clear, and was very, very clear early on: this man is not going to change.
No, he certainly is not. He talked a bit about decision making and his role. He talked about the fact that his main role, let's say, around the ground was the philosophy. He didn't use the word culture. That we sort of seem to use quite a lot, and it is a word that lots of fans use. The culture's not right at Watford. But he said he was sort of in charge of the philosophy of things, which is sort of understandable, but it's not really a thing you work on day to day. Philosophy is set. Philosophy is very overarching. But he also talked a little bit about not making decisions and giving other people control, but that it didn't. You could all... it's an extreme word, but, you know, it's autocracy. It really did feel like sometimes... that's how he spoke, but other times he didn't. So there was contradictions in terms of his place in the running of the club. Do you feel the same?
Yeah, definitely. The answers did tend to slip a little bit in terms of what point Gino and to a certain degree Scott was trying to make. At one stage he was saying if he sees the manager not really performing in training, then he won't hesitate about swinging the axe and getting rid of the manager. And then in another answer, you'd be saying, oh, no, it's not like I'm at the training ground all the time. So there were little discrepancies like that sort of peppered throughout the evening. Without wanting to be too critical, there was a theme with the answers that he said an awful lot without saying very much at all. quite a lot. There was
filibustering, I think it's known as.
Yeah, the Senate or the House of Representatives, yeah, whatever it is, would be very impressed with his ability to filibuster. And yeah, there was no real direct answer, was there, about how involved he is. I think he would like the takeaway to be that he's the guy at the top, sitting in his swivel chair, thinking about where he wants Watford to be, working out how he wants them to get there, hiring the right people to deliver on that strategy, then sitting back and watching it all unfold, getting a big cigar on, putting the A team on and saying, I love it when a plan comes together when they get promoted to the Premier League. I think that's how he'd like us to see him. I just don't think that's the case. It feels like he is very hands-on. It feels like he is, you know, lots of little knowing looks over to Cristiano Giaretta during the evening, I think, and the same with Emiliano Russo. As you'd expect, you know, they're very close. They work together. But if he is setting the... And he did use the word philosophy, but that is where the culture comes from. You have to say, well, you're probably getting it wrong then. Because what you're seeing is the players looking increasingly uncoachable, as I think one of the head coaches has actually said, and as we've seen with our very eyes. So,
and that's where you went. You actually, well, I did give you the microphone in the end, Michael. Yeah, you did have a passionate sort of speech to it all. You know, you do a podcast, you got more confidence in terms of speaking. Lots of people were asking very pertinent questions, but yeah, there was a slight nerve to all that sort of stuff. You really pushed him on actually how we feel as fans, didn't you?
Yeah, because I felt like there wasn't much acknowledgement that things haven't been great. There was the occasional sort of nod to the fact that they recognised we've had a rough couple of seasons, but there was never really any sort of suggestion that they might be looking at different ways to make things better. You kicked it off, John, by asking what's different this time, and the answer wasn't really there. So my question was about whether there's any introspection, really, and whether... Do you look at the fact that the last six managers, for example, haven't been a good fit? And do you not think that perhaps it's not them, it's us? It's not actually the head coach and their methods. The fact that they can't fit into the structure that is set up at Watford isn't because the head coaches aren't talented. Let's not forget, Roy Hodgson sauntered back into Crystal Palace and kept them up at a breeze, with a breeze. You know, it wasn't a problem for him. Yet with us, he could barely muster a shot on goal. So does there come a time, and you would expect as a business owner, if things, you keep doing the same thing but the outcome is the same negative one, you'd stop and think, well, hang on a minute. Surely we've got to change something around the place, because otherwise we're just going to get the same results. So I said, is there any room for introspection? And Scott took it initially and said, well, look, hang on, that's a bit unfair. You need to look at it in the context of the bigger picture. We've had a great period of time where we've achieved a lot. And I pushed back on that as well, because I said, hopefully, you know that we're incredibly grateful for all the good times as supporters. You know, I'm an advocate for always looking at things in context, in the wider context, and what Watford have achieved, a club our size, to achieve what we did under GT, pretty much give or take, apart from Europe, again, is unfathomable, really. And we're all grateful for that, but I think that goes without saying. And I felt that was a bit of an attempt to derail us from asking the deeper point about, are you really going to admit that you've got anything wrong, identify what has gone wrong and try and change it? And yeah, whether we've got a satisfactory answer to that, I'm not really sure. But there's a definite reticence to recognise, at least publicly, mistakes. And maybe they say, well, it's taken as read that we've made mistakes, because if we hadn't made mistakes, we'd still be in the Premier League and we'd have a significantly better squad. So perhaps they just think that's a given. But I just felt the way the evening went, and the way the sort of just the unabashed confidence in what they were doing, which again on one level is right, but to say we're going to keep on doing this sort of utilising this world-class scouting network, this brilliant setup here we've got with the technical team, we're going to carry on using that. Well, if you carry on using it the way you've been using it, we're going to have another disappointing season. And I was a bit disappointed, if you like, that there wasn't any any signs of sort of reticence or introspection or a willingness to say that we've learned and are going to try things slightly different, which was a touch frustrating, I felt.
Yeah, he was not going to do that in that forum, at least,
no.
I think, in front of that many people. Lots of questions came down. We'll get to Moggy by it, don't worry. Moggy by it, sorry.
It is Moggy.
Yeah. Moggy by
Moggy.
It.
Mr. Moggy.
Yes, he did call him that every single time. And the player recruitment in a minute. But the finances, in some ways it might, in terms of the questions from the audience, it was good for me because I knew I had those kicker questions and they were there ready to go. But actually all the questions that were coming from the audience were exactly the type of questions, the topics that wanted to be asked that came through all the submissions that we had via the Slido that we set up for the in part of the organising committee. Finance was a big part of it.
Yeah.
Both very buoyant. Emilio was very buoyant. And he actually, he did, I saw him go over and say, speak to some people who had asked those questions and like sort of go and reassure them or ask if they had any further questions afterwards. £29 million that are what is what we owe. And I think that what's what we owe in terms of to banks.
That's owed to Macquarie, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's going to be gone in 12 months. That's all planned out in terms of gone in 12 months. And we will be debt-free, is what Scott said. And it's like, wow, really? And we did have a little bit further conversation, or someone did at least, I think, with Emilio, where he said, well, that doesn't include money owed to other clubs or part of that finance, the player models. But in terms of the main overall money that we owe, there's still a huge amount owed to Gino, but that's not a problem. That's just a way of him investing money, as every owner does, into the club. It's only going to be a thing when he, if he ever sells the club.
Yeah, I mean, and they went on. So there's some key headline figures there, which is, and perhaps one of the major benefits of having this was that they've gone on record to say that in 12 months we will be debt free. That £29 million that is owed to Macquarie will be paid off. And there'll be no outstanding money. They also said, I'm sure I heard them say, that Gino will never call the loans in.
Yes.
So, and they owner debt was dismissed as something that is very, very, very common in football and was sort of merrily skipped over. But I think the reality is Gino Pozzo is owed a significant amount of money from the football club. And of course, one other question, which was quite interesting, and this one's getting a little bit more, a bit deeper, was why aren't you a director of the football club?
Mm.
Why aren't you named as a director of a football club? And it may astound people to know that I'm a governor at a local school, which and a governor has the same responsibilities as the director. So you have to sign that, and I'm registered at Companies House and all that sort of stuff. And you have to sign up to agree to the director's charter, if you like. One of which is that you mustn't. It would be an illegal offence to do anything that would damage the company that you're a director of. Now, of course, if Gino decided that he wanted his loans and Watford didn't have the money and he took them anyway, he would be damaging the football club because he would be taking money that they need for operating to keep the club going, but he'll take it anyway. If he was a director, he couldn't do that. He'd has the fiduciary duties that are attached to an official directorship, and he wouldn't be able to do that. It'd be a criminal offence. As a non-director, if he does want to call in those loans, and we must say that he said last night he has no plans to do so, but if he does, he could take them, and there'd be no recourse under the sort of the legislation that surrounds being a director. So that's. That's an interesting one. And there were a lot of questions about finance. And I did hear a few moans and groans about the sheer weight of questions about the finance. But, of course, it is a very, very hot topic for a lot of people. Watford have sailed close to the wind previously. We've been close enough to potentially having to support AFC Watford by now a couple of times before. And people, understandably, really don't want to be there again. And the finances don't seem to stack up, really, in terms of, again, they were very bullish. They said the
stack up or make sense to a normal human being who doesn't know a lot about finance and doesn't run a multi-million-pound company?
Well, I would say I don't think they stack up, really. I mean, I'm not great with money at all, as anyone who has ever met me will attest. But if the club is in the best possible financial health, why are the Macquarie loans required? And yes, borrowing money for operating costs is not a different thing. We've all got mortgages, or not everyone, but I know I have, and I use a credit card from time to time. So a credit facility or borrowing money isn't obviously uncommon. But if you're in the best, you know, rudest financial health we've ever been into, would we need to buy and sell back, loan back Hassan Kamara for 15 million quid?
We'll get to him in a minute.
Lots of little different pieces floating around, and there's the weird charge with the Bond brothers, wasn't it? That loan, which there's a lot of confusion around that. And you're right, I am in no way, shape or form qualified to cast aspersions or to delve too deep. But there were plenty of people there last night who seemingly were and were concerned enough to get there to ask some pretty sort of laser-focused, if you like, questions. So the interesting, the headline was, we're in great financial health. We owe 29 million quid to Macquarie, which will be paid in 12 months, then we'll be debt-free. And Gino never wants his loans back. Now, on the face of it, that sounds great.
And that does sound exactly, when we spoke to the Price of Football podcast, to Kieran Maguire, that is what is normal. That's what he said as an outsider is normal. It's very easy for us to look at things from the outside in isolation and understand what they'd be. And it was really, I suppose, the most animated I think Gino got, not that he was an overly animated person, but when he was sort of pushed on the Kamara move and back to Udinese, firstly him and then also to Scott, really did sort of push back on that and, you know, explain things fully. You know, the big thing that Scott said about the Udinese model, the idea was that Kamara wanted to play top division. They were selling him over there so he could be in the top division with Udinese. But Spurs were going to buy the left back from Udinese. But then they bought him, but then they loaned him straight back in. So then he wasn't needed at Udinese. So they got loaned back to Watford. I haven't got the timeline for that. I haven't got where the deal was done. It seemed to be done very quickly. And then the whole thing about the adding on value to players and the bio, the, you know, flipping a player like you flip a house. He spoke about, I felt a bit educated by that. He spoke again about the player who was at Udinese. He'd been on loan at Udinese for a year. The deal there, that was part of the original one that they set out for the loan deal, was to buy him at £2 million. If 3 days later you then sold him for £20 million, which you could, because the value of him has gone up, but the deal was made 12 months beforehand for the obligation to buy, then you've made that money. And it isn't like he's trying to swindle something. It is just the fact that those contracts, and it was like, you know what? I don't know the bigger picture. I don't know about these contracts and who's where and what's what and who has to, you know, they're very, very complicated things. So it's quite interesting to sort of see him animated about that and trying to explain that fully. And Scott was very adamant, animated, that there was no investigation into it. That's what they always do.
They were almost quite affronted, weren't they, that people were questioning these deals. I mean, on the face of it, it's obvious. They're trying to get access to as much cash on the best rates as quickly as possible. Now, Hassan Kamara, it may be that everything just fell into place and it was a chance to realise 15 million quid, which is fine. Watford is under Gino Potter, Watford is a player trading model. That's how they make the money. That's how they generate the money, certainly at the moment in the Championship, where the TV deal and the parachute payments, which, of course, we've mortgaged to Macquarie anyway, are about to run out. That's how they do it. And they were very, blasé is the wrong word, but very comfortable explaining, we're flipping players and we're making money where we can. We're realising cash where we can. So you can take that one of two ways. You can take it to realise, well, they're completely comfortable with it. And on a number of occasions, both Scott and Gino used examples of other clubs doing it and said, well, if you're going to look at us, you also need to look at them then, because they're doing exactly the same thing, which, you know, I hate whataboutery. I think just because they do it doesn't mean we're doing it makes it right. Two wrongs and two wrongs don't make a right and all that jazz. So they made it sound very, very normal. And on one hand, that can put you at ease and say, well, they're operating in the football world. They're the ones that have got the, you know, have to sign off the accounts. Well, Gino doesn't, but Scott does. So they seem to know what they're doing. Let's let them get on with it. But for me, there still seems to be a lot of loose ends and a lot of activity that doesn't quite add up to us being as financially secure as Scott seemed keen to suggest. And I'm not making any criticisms, I'm not making any allegations. What I'm saying is I still harbour fears about the financial future of the football club, especially if we don't go up this season. I think there's just enough loose ends, enough, if they're not red flags, amber flags knocking around the place to suggest that money might be a relatively serious concern for the football club. But if we're to take everything that was said last night as face value, mm-hmm. then we don't need to worry. But I think we know enough to about the footballing world to not take things at face value and not question them. So I think it's very much a case of watch this space, and it'll be fascinating to see what sort of business is done over the summer, because I think that will indicate just how much, if any, money is available for transfers. So I think that will be an early indication of what the account's looking like.
But they did talk about that a little bit in terms of the players' wages. They've spoken several times mentioning the fact that the players that were high earners have left the club, and that has brought down the, I suppose, running costs down massively. So there are no massively high earners at the club anymore. So that's going to help them in terms of not needing, you know, the cash flow will therefore, I suppose, probably be several million pounds less needed. The topic of finance has come back a few times, but Mr. Modgy Byatt did come up, Mr. Modgy. And he, well, it didn't necessarily feel to me, knowing how much he is hanging around games and being guests, Gino spoke quite a lot about, well, and this is what I think, this is what he does. His relationships with agents around the world is part of his thing that he does. And those relationships, he says, are very important, because if we have good relationships, then we are going to be offered players by these agents. And if we get the best offers, then we're going to be in a better position and be able to make more money from these players once we shine them and then sell them. He then sort of, what I wanted him to say was almost, well, Modgy's my friend and he is an agent also, but he comes along and he watches some games of football at my football club because he's also my friend. And that would have made sense into how much he's around the place. But it was also, they did bring up the whole point, which the, you know, Scott's particularly was easy to bat away, where when Modgy did start his club, his business in England, that the same people who set up Watford and the, you know, the parent companies and so whatever of Watford were used at the same time, and they were around and they disappeared after 6 months. And again, it's a different world. It's not one that I live in and I understand very well. But Scott talked about it and explained it about what would have happened, and it makes sense why directorships of this person and that one and what the links are between them, why it completely makes sense. But he did, I don't think he got angry, but again, that bullishness you did see again when he was pushed at least twice on what is the relationship and what is the point of Modgy Byatt.
Yeah, he almost sort of a little bit exasperated, perhaps, was the answer. And perhaps that was a bit of a tell that he didn't necessarily want to talk about. And I thought the answers around this were disappointing, really. And the biggest attempt at a fudge, I felt, was around Modgy Byatt, because the argument seemed to be every club uses agents. We haven't got a favoured agent. He's just one that is able to deliver value from time to time for us. That just isn't true. We know for a fact that Modgy Byatt isn't just a player's agent. He acts for the club in deals as well. He sits up in the upper Graham Taylor set with a Watford coat on. We've seen it. Like you say, John, you're looking for any reason as to why that is the case. And, it, you know, we're mates. Would be fine.
Yeah,
he was in town, or, but we know he's very, very present at the football club, and to sort of say that we use lots of agents, we don't have a favourite one, he just happens to be one that does deals for us for time to time. I'm not buying that, really. And as the point was made by a question from the floor, we seem to be the only club, certainly in this country, utilising his services. That may or may not be the case, but it seems like that, And the reasons are that he's embroiled in a number of court cases. Now, obviously, there remains to be seen what the outcome of those is, and we've got no idea what will happen there. But the question remains, for someone who is involved in less than in court cases, if there's a court case, something's gone wrong somewhere along the line, hasn't it? So do you want to be involved with people like that? I would suggest probably not. And did we get a satisfactory answer as to why we are still heavily involved with him?
No,
we didn't. And that's disappointing. So I think the questions around him and what that means, it's another one of those flags, isn't it?
It's a cloud that's still hanging over there. And I was expecting every cloud to be pushed away last night, but that one definitely is darker, and it is definitely... just hanging around still.
One for us to keep an eye on as fans, John. And I think what's important about all of these answers is that they are on record now. Andrew has probably spent more time than is healthy transcribing everything that was said. So there is a written record of what was said. And now Watford supporters can use these as a reference point and go back to them and ask them. And we can have to, they can be used as discussion points on podcasts, in fanzines, in the pubs, at the... You know, it's all out there now, and I'd urge everyone to read as much as you can about it, so we can see what has actually been said, and then see if what happens in the coming months actually stacks up. But there are definitely things that now they're out there and have been said, we can use them to hold the club to account in our role as critical friends. We're not trying to trip them up. We want the finances to be amazing. We want Monty Byatt to be absolutely squeaky clean and delivering us good players and good value week in, week out. We want Gino to be acting in the best interests of the club every single day. We want his non-directorship to be for good reasons and not bad ones. But they're all questions as supporters we're entitled to ask and to keep asking. And it's just good that we had the opportunity to put them last night. But the Modgy answers, not good enough for me, I don't think.
No, I was sort of going into this where we need to ask every question to Gino, as much as possible to Gino. And there was a spell in the questioning. It wasn't really questioning. It was fans just wanting to share their experiences at this point of what's been happening recently, particularly one female fan, Emma, where she really wanted to share how some bad incidents that have happened that she's felt terrible about. She talked about the toxicity on Twitter, and hey, if you're on it, you know it. But she did talk about bad things that have happened to her and her five-year-old at a game, and almost like it was being steered off. I thought, no, this is not what this should be about. This should not be about this. This is about Gino. We can deal with that later. But how Scott reacted afterwards, the minute we finished, he made a beeline for Hilda, who also took part in that section, to speak with her more directly. And actually, the idea that these top level people are now aware of these things. Not that it's been hidden from them or anything like that. It was just not worried them about it, because the club does whatever the club does. The ladies definitely felt that they didn't think or know if things had been done. But it was good to see Scott be so reactive and to speak to them and want to know more about that, those incidents, and how those women felt.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Hilda and Emma that felt that. There were lots of agreements and lots of murmurings of agreement and nods, and the sort of vibe did change, didn't it, when people were talking about that. It felt, it did get the juices going a little bit, as much as it felt like it struck a chord. And I, you know, I have to say, in the since COVID, I think the away ends have been... they've been different. They've had a bit of an edge to them, and you can, on one hand, you can appreciate that it's the weekend, or you've got a afternoon off work to go and let some steam off. That's what football's supposed to be all about, and we all know that away ends are raucous and exciting and noisy, and can get a little bit over exuberant sometimes. We all accept that, and we all enjoy it. You know, we've all been there. We love it, a noisy, bouncy, raucous away end is one of the best places to be on earth. But there doesn't need to be really, really bad behaviour. There doesn't need to be fighting amongst other fans. There doesn't need to be accusations amongst fellow fans. And that's what's been happening. And it was obviously felt very, very keenly by plenty of people in the room. And Emma was very animated in in getting her point across. And like you, it felt a bit incongruous, but what I actually having had some time to think about it, it was obviously so important to her that she shared that with the top people at the club, and I'm really, really glad she did. And what was impressive, John, like you say, was Scott's unhappy reaction to it. He spoke to Hilda straight after because she said that there'd been some incidents. He asked me about it afterwards. He said, what's it like at away games? And I said exactly as I've just described there. It does feel a little bit problematic at times, and that's not the way it should be. I repeat everything I said. It should excite, you know, exuberant, bouncy, noisy, a little bit edgy from time to time. That's absolutely fine. We know what it is. But there is a line, and I think far too often that line's been crossed. But what was interesting and quite reassuring was that it felt like it was quite upsetting to them, as obviously as senior custodians of the football club, they want their supporters to be having a good experience and a safe, happy experience. And I think the fact that so obviously wasn't the case for so many people was concerning for them, and that's as it should be. But it was good. I think Scott took some details and took some numbers, so we'll hopefully be pushing that on. So I'm glad that Emma took the sort of seized the moment and got her feelings across, and she did so sort of passionately but articulately as well. It was a sort of quite, and it's probably one of the most emotionally charged moments of the night by quite some margin.
Yeah, and we sort of finished off the evening. There were odds and sod questions. Again, the details and everything is in Andrew's piece. It was something that Scott said, and I suppose I went into this wanting to know the reset in terms of a mindset for what the football is and what the management is and how that's going. But actually, the biggest telling thing was how Scott described the club right near the end. He said, "We are an EFL club. We're a top 30 club." That really stuck with me. It's pretty much what was said about Watford before the Pozzos. That's always where we were aiming to be. We are this. If we can be this and have some times up in the Premier League, that's a good thing. And less than 5 years ago, Scott was sort of saying the next level up. We want to be an established Premier League team. And maybe we might be able to go up a little bit and maybe go into Europe if everything sort of goes in the right direction. But I suppose that I was quite very welcoming of that, and hoping maybe the more people know that that's how they're viewing themselves, at least at the moment, that's a healthy mindset to have for the current situation we find ourselves in. Do you think the same, Mike?
Yeah, sort of. I did find it a bit peculiar. I think what he was trying to suggest was that we are well established at this level, and we are well established as a base to really, to have a go at the Championship, I think, was what he meant. This is probably, you know, the Championship is, well, maybe not even the Championship, but around the EFL is Watford's natural level, certainly over history. And if you look at the size of the town, the catchment area, the regular match-going fan numbers, for example, that is right. And I guess it does, yeah, was he trying to realign expectations? I'm not sure that's what he was getting at. I think he was sort of saying more about, well, we are established, we're a solid club with good infrastructure, good people, and a good opportunity to give it a good go. I think that's what he was getting at, perhaps. I did, like you, it could have meant
But that's very different. Have a good go is different from we're pushing for the Premier League.
Yeah.
That is different.
And Gino did, in his opening remarks, also was at pains to point out that the Premier League is a very different place to what it was when Gino Pozzo and the Pozzo family arrived a decade ago. He made that point as well. So there was a sort of subtle, perhaps, theme running through the night that things have changed. Let's recognise where we are as a football club, which is an established and EFL side, a comfortable EFL side, one that is equipped to perform well at that level, and let's do as well as we can and see where it takes us. Is that what you were getting at, do you think?
Again, I went into that looking for something, and I was looking for someone to show me some sort of where I realistically see us. And Scott did say that, but like I say, you looked at it differently because you saw him just sort of trying to say this is what we are and this is a good thing. So it is always fascinating when people say things how you read them differently, how you take things in differently. But no, it's almost something that I want more people to just make sure they know, to lower those expectations or understand what we are now, not what we were a year ago. We're not what we were 3 years ago, not what we were 5 years ago.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that, though, is it does fly in the face of all their sort of the confidence and bullishness that was abound for the other perhaps three quarters of the evening, doesn't it? It felt a little bit out of kilter with their suggestions.
Well, it did feel a little bit as Scott was trying to add that at the end.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I want to make sure I say. He didn't get the chance to say this, what he wanted to say. He wanted to say this in the room, and the questions didn't either come to him or didn't come up him say it. Almost like he just wanted to make sure he said that at the end.
Yeah, potentially. And I think you're probably right. I mean, for me, it feels like and I think it's probably happened last year was so bad that expectations have kind of automatically reset a little bit. There was absolutely no stage really last year where we looked like we were going to challenge seriously for promotion, was there? It was such a bitty, sort of disappointing, underachieving season. And of course, we've got no idea what the squad's going to look like next year compared to this. There was a swathe of lone players who had all have gone back, and we know Ismail Assar will be out of the building hopefully sooner rather than later for everyone's sake. Not that I want rid of him, just to get that saga over and done with. So there's going to major surgery is required on the squad one way or another, and it just remains to be seen whether that major surgery delivers something that is able to compete in the top half potentially. But I think my expectations have certainly levelled out after a year in the Championship. It didn't take long. I think we should still always be looking to be as good as we can, because we've tasted it, haven't we, under Gino Pozzo. And last night he wasn't taking a backward step at all. He was definitely saying it's my way or the highway. There's no way he's changing his plans. There's no way, and you can imagine what it must be like arguing with him. Very well, not difficult, impossible.
Yeah, you'd imagine him just sat there, just being quiet, and go, no. And then you say, but this and that, and you go, no.
He looks at you, and he's very engaging. You know, when he answered my question, he was looking at me. He was very demonstrative and very, you know, lots of facial features. He was engaged with it. He wasn't just trotting out an answer. But you know full well that he's looking at you. He's speaking, you know, kindly to you, and he's the occasional smile. But you know effectively what he's saying is, yeah, look, mate, I hear what you're saying, but I'm absolutely just going to do what I want anyway. That is it. And I'm sure that's what it's like, whether it's Scott talking to him to a lesser or greater degree as well, or other people. He's tough. He really doesn't give a rat's backside what other people think of him or how he goes about it. That much is evident. Despite his sort of quite softly spoken delivery and his friendly demeanour, like we say, he was very, very open to being spoken to last night. And I expected them to walk out the back door and we wouldn't see him again. He was there for, like you say, John, probably a good 90 minutes. Anyone that wanted to speak to Gino had that opportunity. But that to one side, you know, you could tell just by the way he answers his questions, I'm going to tell you what I want to tell you. And basically what I want to tell you is that I'm right. And I'm going to continue to make decisions in the way that I see fit.
Do you feel, you know, they are men who are in positions, and when you're in that position in such a public sort of place, blame is given to you, and in many ways, rightly so. Do you feel any empathy, more empathy, let's say, for them? You're a very empathic person, Michael, for them after sort of hearing from Gino for the first time?
I've definitely got empathy for them, in as much as running a football club is excruciatingly difficult. We've seen that any number of factors can impact on your ability to achieve success. So there was COVID, Sarr's been injured, Delafeu got injured, for example. All of those things, the whole thing, success can rest on the smallest or most unexpected of things. It's organised chaos. There are players on manoeuvres the whole time. There are agents on manoeuvres the whole time. There's the expectations of supporters. There's ever-changing financial rules. There's ever-changing financial markets. The ever-changing cost of football. The whole thing is an absolute minefield. So anyone who is trying to run a football club, I have empathy for, absolutely. I think too many people expect success. Too many people think it's a linear journey to say, well, let's spend £100 million, buy the best players we can, and success will follow. I think there's far too much of that sort of A to B binary expectation, which is a nonsense. The reason we love football is that anything can happen. We've seen that. We've seen miracles happen. We've seen heartbreak. We've seen delight and excitement. So that is what football is, and it's like lightning in a bottle. It's impossible to catch it, really. It's not impossible, but it's hard. So I do have empathy in that regard. What I don't have sympathy for is effectively not coming out and speaking before today. We've seen that full well that he's got the courage of his convictions. So come out and say it. Just come out and say it. Say, hi, Watford fans. I'm aware that you think that the club's going to go to hell in a handcart. However, let me assure you, I really still want the club to succeed. The money's fine. I want to carry on doing that because that is what I firmly believe is the right thing. Just say that, and at least you're saying something, and then you're not opening yourself up to the criticism of just hiding in a bunker somewhere. Because that's he's effectively become the boogeyman. Because and still not many people have heard him speak because of the contentious issue around the audio, which I still think was a massive, massive shame. So a lot of people still haven't heard him speak, and I think that is. And he did go to great lengths to explain that. He said he's a very private person, he doesn't like doing it. But there is an argument that and a lot of club owners don't speak often. For a range of reasons that are probably pretty obvious. Things get misquoted and it can affect value and all that sort of stuff. But you can do a little bit more, especially when there's been seemingly sort of very, very questionable decisions and things that people are concerned about. Monchi buyout, for example. If people are concerned about, and if your answer is going to be, well, he's just one of a number of agents we use, well, just come out and say it then.
Yeah, because the silence and the gaps can be filled with rumour.
Yeah.
I've
always said that we're not going to get, you know, headline answers from an owner.
No.
And I've always said that I haven't really got an urge for us to speak to him because, by and large, you can guess what he's going to say. He did take me by surprise last night by the way he approached it. But so I don't expect, you know, talking to fans all the time. But I think he sort of painted himself into a bit of a corner. So I don't have sympathy with some of the decisions there in terms of the communications, and some of the decision making has looked a bit skew-iff, and the wheels have fallen off a little bit. And when things are going well, you don't have to say anything. And he would have been accused of sort of being the milkman version too, I guess. But I do think he could have been a little bit more visible and a little bit more vocal in sort of explaining the vision and the direction of travel and what he was hoping to achieve and how he was going to do it. Even if it is just to say, trust me, I'm sticking with this plan. It's tried and tested. That's what I'm going to do. At least you can be impressed by the courage of his convictions there, even if you don't agree with it. So, but yeah, I do have empathy and sympathy for how hard it is to run a football club. But you can help. You can keep the fans on side with a few simple techniques, if you like.
And yeah.
Some would argue they might be sort of meaningless platitudes, but hearing from people means a lot to supporters. It's a thing that football first supporters invest a lot of money, time, and emotion into. And just sometimes all they need is a little crumb, a little nod, or a bit of recognition, and that's probably has been lacking a little bit over the last couple of difficult seasons.
And in some ways, if you know, he's right. He needs to speak when it's needed, and when it's needed is an interesting definition and different for everybody, I suppose. I suppose what he needs to, if I was his PR agent, I would probably say, look, you need to, you know, you said you're in charge of this philosophy. What is this philosophy? And anything he gave in that forum was a very short answer. The kind of thing you say if you were in a tunnel and you were the manager giving a post-match interview. He didn't share it, but you would like to hear about it through demonstration rather than through doing a PowerPoint presentation in front of a bunch of fans. You know, his footballing loves, his footballing, you know, things he thinks are excellent in football, things he thinks are bad in football. Just know a bit about him, like his desert island discs for football. You know, just to know about him and his love of the game, which he explained, as well as his, yeah, that's why he does what he does. But it's hopefully, yeah, again, we're told by Scott that he is going to be doing a lot more, and the club will be doing a lot more of these at your places, going out away from the ground to just talk to people, to press the flesh a little bit more. And I think we did see that a little bit yesterday when he found out a little bit more about the incidents that happened. Maybe he hasn't been aware of those sorts of things. He is now, and hopefully will do, and he will continue to in the future. So we're hoping that next year these things will continue and not have to feel so dramatic when it comes to it. And there are other things that Gino could do to share himself without it being a Twitter account. God, dear God, don't get one, Gino. Or just having to do these fans for him. There are other things that he can do to keep that connection. You know, I suppose my thing, you do feel, of course, empathy for what they have to do. I suppose my big takeaway was the fact that it was interesting that I don't think about football and I don't know about football as much as he does. I look at it completely differently. But overall, Mike, it was what we expected, wasn't it? It was to hear from him, but not really hear that much.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, ultimately, the big win is that the event happened. It was a difficult ask to the supporters as a whole, and the supporters did make it happen. I thought there were some good questions asked in the room. I thought Gino and Scott took most things with good grace. There was definitely a lot of talking around answers. There wasn't very much in the way of direct, right, slot tab A into slot B type answers that would neatly box everything off. There was never any of that really, but I think we all suspected that to be the case. I always thought that owners and senior officials are always going to dance around the main, mm-hmm. the main topics. They're going to say that we've got the best interest of the club in heart. We're doing everything we can to deliver success for you, the fans, who we really appreciate. We're doing everything we can to keep us moving in the right direction. We think the new head coach is going to do well. We're looking at players that are going to suit us. You can rattle it all off. The most important thing is the club listened, the event happened, and it feels like it should be now the springboard for more events. As you say, John, they've announced that At Your Places are going to be happening every couple of months, every 8 weeks, which is a huge fillip, I think. Those events were really, really good. Off the record, quite casual surroundings. They've been in pubs and cricket clubs and that sort of things. And it's a chance to sit down in a relaxed, informal setting with people who really do know the ins and outs of the football club and talk to them and express your feelings, because I think that's a massive thing for football supporters, just to be able to get it out. We saw with Emma earlier, we spoke about Emma. She was very frustrated and upset, and she managed to get it out, and there was a response, which is good. And I think those At Your Places are really good. So if those coming off the back of this is if this event has proved to be the catalyst for that, then that makes it all worthwhile in itself. So, look, for personally, I thought it was absolutely fascinating to see Gino operating up close. Really, really interesting. Like I said earlier, you got a real sense of who he is. Absolutely stone cold belief in what he's doing is the right hand thing. Is the right thing. Changing that bloke's mind must be the devil's own job. Forget it. Negotiating with him must be an absolute nightmare. I think he puts me in mind a little bit of Logan Roy without the swearing, certainly in public anyway. I didn't hear a swear word uttered last night, but just absolutely set on knowing what he wants to do, knowing how he's going to achieve it, and not really countenancing much much opinion from others to sway that decision. He is a tough, tough cookie, a very, very smooth operator, and someone who has absolute and unshakable belief that what he does is right. So, look, I think the bottom line is, if anyone's hoping, you know, I was asking for a bit of introspection, you're not going to get an apology for Gino for getting things wrong, because that he's going to carry on doing the things he's done. He made that abundantly clear last night. So if anyone was sort of going along last night hoping to hear Gino say, yep, I recognise that the way I've done things for the last couple of years has been incorrect. We've made mistakes, so therefore we're going to make changes. Absolutely not a bit of it. So anyone hoping for that is going to be left very, very disappointed. So Gino's at the wheel at the moment, and it is like it or lump it. I think Michael Hart, who was on the vice chair of the Watford Supporters Trust and was there last night, made a really good point, saying if what you want to do is support the team and just turn up and support the team, that is absolutely great. Get on and do that. Enjoy your trips to Vicarage Road. Hopefully you enjoy the away days. But if you're worried, if the answers aren't satisfactory and you do want to push further, then do get mobilised to be in a position where you can ask sort of searching questions and dig a little bit deeper into some of the things you might be concerned about. Now's the time, I think, for people to act in the way they think is best. But that action has to be positive. It has to manifest itself in positive actions with good and solid and reasonable intent. As we see in the news, you know, the too many people acting in bad faith. They're not doing things for the right reasons. But if you don't believe in Gino, then and you want to do something about it, then by all means do. But it has to be for the right reasons, and it has to be proactive and productive. Any hope that he's going to sort of fall on his sword and say, oh, sorry, guys, you know, got it wrong.
Never going to happen. Never going to happen.
Forget it. So a fascinating evening. We finally have got a grip, or certainly I feel like I've got much more of a grip on who Gino Pozzo is. Impressive on a number of levels, but also you can see that level of the reasons he's impressive could also be the reasons that he's problematic, if that makes sense.
Well, we'll see what happens with the wheelings and dealings, the comings and goings, the whatever happens at Watford next year. We'll talk about it on the podcast. I think, Mike, this is season 13. I think after today, I will renumber the podcast. They will be season 14. But for now, this is the end of season 13. But hopefully it's a start. We know that actually it's got to be, because the players come back for pre-season on Monday. So season 14 of From the Rookery End technically starts on Monday when all the players are back. The big thing we learned, Valerian, they love the attitude. They're impressed with him when he was at Barnsley. They understand everything that went wrong at West Bromwich Albion. They're not going on a pre-season trip. They're staying at home. They've got 7 weeks. And Monday they start getting ready for the first game of the championship season. And that is, well, interesting to see if it works. But it is. You know, they're going to stick around Watford. They're going to stick around the training ground and stay local because they've got a lot of hard work to do. And I think we can all agree there is a lot of hard work to do. Thank you very much, Michael.
Cheers, John. Cheers, everybody. Interesting times, as always, at WDAT.
Always. And we'll be here to talk about it again next year, of course, with season 14 of From the Rookery End. And do follow us on the old social medias, at Watford Podcast. And if you get anything that comes to mind for this and anything in the future, always send us your lovely long-form emails, podcast@fromtherookerend.com. Come on, you horns!